This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Forbidding, here shamans still fly through the night. Hidden valleys conceal portals to other worlds. Yetis leave footprints in the snow, spirits and demons abound, and the gods are appeased by the blood of sacrificed beasts. That's Arunachal Pradesh, not the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, although I'm sure Antonio will be right at home, as in conversation with Julia Wheeler, you give them a very warm welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, Antonia Bolingbroke-Kent.
Welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Can you all hear me? Yeah? Great at the back. Great. Wonderful. And welcome to you, Antonia Bolingbroke-Kent, who is going to tell us about her journey up through the land of the dawn-lit mountains. And to begin with, what we're going to do is start off with a film just to give you a little bit of a flavour of that journey. There we go. Do we have sound? There is.
It's 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm in the middle of Namdapha National Park, which is dense, dense jungle. God knows what's lurking and prowling and purring and slithering in that dark green mass. I decided this trip that I would do the sort of vulnerable travel thing. I would just trust in humanity and the universe that it was going to be okay. Just watched six Mithans being sacrificed. I'm a vegetarian. Can't really deal with animal sacrifice first thing in the morning.
Happy Holi. What do you reckon? Yeah, that's you. That's you there.
We are nearly at the site of where an American C-46 crashed in February 1945. Down here, there's bits of parachute, so obviously the men didn't have time to get out.
Meters.
These things are good for you, right? These things that really test you. That's why we do adventures. That's why we plunge into the unknown. We take the risks, because every time you overcome something like this, you overcome your fears. You face your fears and you overcome them. Then you realize you're a little bit stronger than you thought you were. So what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, right?
Lovely. Well, let's find out if it did. First of all, let's just get an idea of where this idea for going to Arunachal Pradesh came from, because it's not an area that anybody who's been to India, and I bet there are some people in the audience who have been to India. Are there? Hands up. Okay. Who's been to Arunachal Pradesh? One person. Great. You win. You win. but it's not somewhere that people would necessarily think of India, let's go there. So tell us a little bit about it and where the idea came from.
First, I want to check if my microphone's working.
It doesn't sound as if it is. Can we have have we got a handheld mic that we might be able to just start with? bear with. Here it comes. Thank you, Alad.
Is that working?
It will be once he gets back to the booth. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Okay, is that working? You can hear me. Okay, fantastic. So I've traveled to India quite a lot before this journey. But I think, like a lot of people who think they know India quite well, I just wasn't aware that there was this whole other part, this tribal northeast. And it was actually, I have another life as a TV producer. And it was when I was working on a TV production in Delhi about 5 years ago, and my local producer was a Bengali who had traveled, one of the few outsiders who had traveled extensively here. And during the week we spent working together, he just fired my imagination with tales of this unmapped wilderness in India's far northeast, where there were yeti sightings and sacred valleys and matrilineal tribes. So I just thought then, I've got to go to this place. It's going to be the subject of my next book.
And so it is right up there on the border, and parts of it are disputed, aren't they? Or that border is certainly disputed.
Yes, so it's very, this whole region of northeast India, the bit underneath the Red Arrow, is very, not only very culturally and geographically distinct from the rest of the subcontinent, but the Brits in 1914, as we were very good at doing during the Age of Empire, drew a border just where underneath that Red Arrow is, along the Indo-Tibetan borderline. And the Chinese never agreed to this border, and they still don't agree to the border. So to this day, the whole of Arunachal is claimed by China and called South Tibet. Mm. So it's a very disputed region.
Mm. We have to say, you've seen in the film that ants travelled by motorbike, but that's not actually the oddest form of transport that you've ever used, is it?
No, so it all started with this. 11 years ago, my best friend Joe and I, we drove this tuk-tuk called Ting Tong, 12,561 miles from Bangkok to Brighton. And we broke the highly competitive Guinness World Record for the longest ever journey by auto rickshaw. So I kind of got into a habit of travelling in unusual vehicles, but I thought a tuk-tuk wouldn't really be suited to the mountains of Arunachal.
No, I think that's absolutely right. But the bike that you found when you got there, it has a great name.
Yes, so this is my Hero Impulse, which was a 150cc, 300 quid purchase from a city called Guwahati in Assam. I wanted to buy a local cheap bike, and hopefully it would live up to its name.
So one of the things that you had to sort out was in terms of the kit, getting it all on there. And there's a lovely story in the book about this top box and how that was created.
Yes, so I was going on a long journey on a very small bike in very extreme environments. So it was going to be very wet, it was going to be snowing, it was going to be hot, I was going to be in remote areas. So I had to pack tool kits and medical kits and laptops and camera gear and sleeping bags. And one thing I had to have, that because this is the wettest region on Earth, is a waterproof top box. And such a thing did not exist in Guwahati, so I had to get it made for me. And it's a long story, but it was the most incredible debacle getting this top box made. And it was eventually finished the night before I left. And only sort of half fitted and half the screws were missing and the paint was still wet when I left. So anyway, it was waterproof and it was a top box.
I think it's fantastically admirable. You said in the film that you trusted to the universe, but you are a lone woman on a bike, not any metal around you, in an area where that doesn't happen, does it?
Well, you know, I like doing things that are exciting. And the great thing about traveling by motorbike is that you're very connected to your environment. You can feel and smell everything. And it's a much more economical way of traveling. You know, I couldn't afford to travel in a big 4x4. And also, this is how local people travel, and I want to travel in a way which local people recognise and can connect to. And also, on a bike, I can really easily stop and say hello to people. I'm not behind this, you know, metal and glass cage of a four-wheel drive. So I just think it's a very open, accessible means of transport.
And what was people's general reaction to you on the bike?
I think often because I was in bike gear, people didn't realise I was a girl until I came past. And then they'd be like, it's a woman. But then often people were just so kind. I mean, particularly the tribal people in Arunachal. They were always going, you're so brave. And I had this feeling that they wanted to sort of look after me. And they would always like get in touch with their friends in the next village or their relatives in the next village. And sort of they almost tried to mollycoddle me because they were sort of worried that something was going to happen.
And in terms of the actual driving, I mean, we can see there... one of the signs, but there are some other classic signs, aren't there?
The Border Roads Organisation, I mean, I think they have a very busy department of sign writers somewhere doing things like this. After whiskey, driving risky. If you're married, divorce speed. Be a Mr. Late, not a Mr. Never.
Or a late mister.
Or a late mister, yes. Was it? Yeah. And, this one was don't gossip, let him drive. Yeah.
Good advice for us all, ladies.
Not sexist at all. So I had a lot of laughs over the signs there.
Yeah. And what about the etiquette of the road?
Well, the first part of my journey was in Assam, where there are 30 million people squeezed into an area the size of Scotland, and the traffic was insane. And it was just basically I'm the bottom of the pecking order, you know. Mm. The cows are above me, lorries are above me, motorbike, foreigner on a motorbike, get out the way or die, basically. But luckily, in Arunachal, there was hardly any traffic. It was either army trucks or occasionally shared taxis. So, really, I was on my own.
Okay, so let's get off on the journey. The first part was up into the Mishmi Hills here.
Yes, so the sort of eastern section of Arunachal is this... area of wild, trackless ranges stretching up to the border with Tibet called the Mishmi Hills. And during the colonial era, there was one explorer who described them as the most formidable in the whole of India. And they were famed for their terrible climate and extreme inaccessibility and violent locals. Nothing's changed today much. Okay, not the violent locals, we'll talk about that in a bit. But it was still a pretty pretty extreme place to travel in.
But it looks beautiful.
Very, very beautiful. Just miles and miles and miles of thickly forested mountains. And then stretching up to the wall of Tibet and some sort of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 metre peaks.
Mm. And what about the tribal people there?
So in the Mishmi Hills, there are the Mishmi people. And the main subgroup who I spent time with, the Idu Mishmi. And the Idu Mishmi are incredibly tough, mountain-dwelling Tibeto-Burman animists who had come down from Tibet sometime about 800 years ago. And like the landscape they now inhabit, they had a pretty formidable reputation during the colonial era. So British explorers variously wrote about them as being dirty, deceitful, dangerous savages who were very averse to strangers. And... there were rumours that they were cannibals who ate the bride's mother at weddings. And so I suppose I entered the Mishmi Hills with some trepidation, considering really nothing has been written about this region since the colonial era. Mm. So I wasn't quite sure about the reception I was going to get.
And what sort of reception did you get?
Well, I'm still here. so I couldn't have got a better reception. What I've quickly found out is that the Idu Mishmi had this very strong tradition that anyone who disrespects a guest will die a horrible death. So they really looked after me. They fed me rice wine and whiskey, and I stayed in their homes, and they told me their stories, and it was the most incredibly heartwarming, wonderful experience being amongst them.
I must say that in the book, there are quite a few tales of you getting drunk with
don't say that. Yeah,
well, I mean, the reason that I mention that is just because I wonder how much you kind of have to open yourself up to those sort of experiences as well as the ones that you've planned.
Well, I think one of my rules when I travel is to say yes within reason, and I think and I'm not saying you should, that sounds like I'm a terrible alcoholic.
Not
here, drink this bottle of whiskey. Of course.
But perhaps it might have been rude to refuse.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of like rice wine. All the different tribes drank their own rice wine and made their own rice wine. And it was part of the sort of hospitality thing. I couldn't say no.
And what did it taste like?
Deceptively like orange juice, but actually, like, after two glasses, you can barely stand up.
Orange juice with a kick.
Sort of fizzy orange juice. Rather tasty.
Okay. So tell us about some of the people that you met and the other things that you got up to.
Well, when I was with the Eden Mishmi, I was incredibly lucky to find out that there was this very rare festival going on up in the mountains. It was called Ray, and it involved 5 days of shamanic chanting and animal sacrifice. And it was taking place in this tiny village right on the Tibetan border. And when I was told about it, I was at a village right at the bottom of the mountains, about a day's journey away. And the one road north had been blocked by landslides for days. And this girl who told me about it said, "You've got to go to this festival." She said, "I don't know how you're going to get there because the road's closed and there's no telephone reception up there. So I'm just going to somehow get a message to one of the people in my clan that there's a foreigner coming and they need to look after you." So she said, "Just get in a shared taxi tomorrow morning. Leave your bike behind. Hopefully the landslides will be cleared then. And go up into the mountains in the shared taxi. And at about dusk, you'll come to a village. And just get out of the village and wait. And someone will pick you up."
That is trusting the universe.
I really trusted the Edu, though, by this stage. So the next morning, I did as she said. I got in this taxi with about 8 other Edu and some piglets and chickens. And at dusk, got out of this village and waited. And eventually, long after dark, this car appeared, and out stepped this handsome young Edu tribesman who was wearing this big cane helmet like this chap here, and he had a big sword around his waist, and he said, "Hello, my name is Sadhu Mihu. I come to take you to the festival." And so I trustingly got into his car, and we disappeared off into the mountains, and I spent 5 days at this festival, and I stayed with this man, Sadhu, and his extended family and the clan, they could not have been friendlier again. So I met their shamans. So it was a very shamanic festival, as I said before. And this man in the middle is their chief shaman. And what they did is they chanted for days on end, and they were offering up the souls of the soon-to-be-sacrificed animals to their spirits, sort of saying, "I tell you what, we'll sacrifice these animals for you, and in return, you've got to give us good harvest." So, yeah, I met these shamans who were really, really... they didn't speak English, but their chanting was very mesmerizing. Mm. And this was what it was all about, animal sacrifice. Julia told me I wasn't allowed to show any of the gory photos, which you already saw in the video. but, yeah, a lot of animals were sacrificed there. And it was quite difficult to watch.
Yeah, and so, not least because, as you said in the film, you are vegetarian. So, I mean, how did you cope with that side of things?
I mean, I was respectful that this is their way and that they've been doing this for hundreds of years, and that really, who am I to come in as a Westerner and tell them how to do things? But it was still really hard for me to watch, just to see an animal being killed and dying quite slowly. Nothing was wasted. Like, within an hour of those animals dying, they'd been chopped up and butchered, and they were being cooked, and they were all feasted. Everything was feasted on later in the day. So although I'm a vegetarian, it was really hard to watch. It was also a real lesson. Like, actually, isn't it better for the animals to live wild all their lives and then have this quick, brutal end than many of the industrial farming methods we had? Mm-hmm. So it was difficult to watch, but I understood why they were doing it.
And did they understand and didn't take offence at the fact that you were not going to partake in that, and presumably you had rice?
Yeah. No, they were just always terribly worried that I was going to starve to death, but Luckily I'd packed lots of emergency packets of biscuits.
And we've got a string of tongues on the right, and a great story of this chap in the wide-brimmed hat on the left. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so he was a very famous Edu hunter called Buge, and you can see the scar on his cheek. And he got this scar from when he was a young man, and he was caught unawares by a bear in the jungle, and he wrestled the bear with his bare hands, and the bear ran away. And this is a man who's about 4'11", but just tough as biltong. And he had 17 children, 16 of them died. One of them became the first woman in Northeast India to climb Everest. So he was a really extraordinary man.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this was the chief shaman again. And he was a really incredible man to be in the presence of. And I heard lots of stories about him, the fact that he had apparently brought people back from the dead and called rain to put out fires. He had walked across rivers on threads. He had communicated with tiger spirits, stopped tigers from marauding their village. But it was very sad because what he said is that all the young people were sort of moving away to the cities. So he had four children and none of them wanted to become shamans. They all wanted to be living in the cities. Mm. And he was a really good example of just how their tribal cultures are just on the cusp of huge change. Mm. On the one hand, very traditional, and on the other hand, the youth are draining away.
Mm. It is sad. So is it difficult to move on from here? Did you get quite institutionalised with this festival?
I just got very attached to the Edu Mishmi. I'm still in touch with a lot of my Edu friends and I really intend to go back. I just felt so welcome there and I loved them. Yeah, so it was hard to move on.
But I have to say that the place that you moved on to was Shangri-La. So
yes, so we've all heard of the legend of Shangri-La, hidden Himalayan valley of great beauty where everyone's very happy and lives to a great age. And according to Buddhist belief, there is such a place in this part of India, in the wild mountains on the Indo-Tibetan border. It's where that circle is. And it's called Pemico. So I rode my little bike right up into the mountains and got to this place, Tooting, you see on the map. And then because there's no roads there, I had to leave my bike and walk. And the belief is that this Pemico is a magical valley where the rivers flow with enchanted water and everyone lives till they're 100 and something and everyone's very happy. And I wanted to go and see if such a place really did exist. But the belief also says that it's a very, very hard place to reach and that there's leeches and flies and fanged animals and terrible weather and that the gods will do everything to try and stop you getting there, that only a few people can reach it. So I wasn't sure what lay ahead.
And, I wonder whether, if you've got a myth like Shangri-La, it's got to be difficult to get there, hasn't it?
Yeah,
otherwise it'd be overrun. And then it would be spoiled and all the rest of it. So tell us about that journey on foot.
Yeah, so I had this guide called Dorje. I had to have a guide because I was very near the disputed Indo-Tibetan border. And we set off on foot. We crossed this river. This is the Brahmaputra. And then we walked east for a week through this very remote land in the mountains. Occasionally we'd come through villages like this, Tibetan villages. Just all the people who lived here were the descendants of pilgrims who'd struggled over the mountains from Tibet in search of this promised land. It was incredibly wet, as was predicted in the scriptures, or whatever you call it. It rained solidly for a week. It was muddy, it was misty, there were leeches. I took to wearing this very fetching outfit all the time. It was tough going. But it was very much made up for by the fact that we were staying in these tribal villages and every night we'd sit around the fire with these families and my guide Dorje would translate what the people were saying and I heard stories about holy men whose bodies had dissolved into rainbows after their death and goats that had eaten magical grasses and meditated for the rest of their lives. And it was, I did sort of feel like I'd gone into another dimension. Mm. It did eventually stop raining. Got to this place, Tashigong, which means cheerful mountain, and the sun came out, and the view was, it was the most beautiful place, this Pemico, just panorama of forested mountains and the white wall of Tibet. It was, fantastic.
And what about the people that you met there? How did they differ, first of all, to the tribal people that you've met earlier, perhaps?
Very different because they're very strongly Buddhist. They're from the Monpa, Kampa, and Memba tribe, so all Tibetan Buddhists. But the thing that really struck me about the people here was that, this is a tough life. You're living amongst tigers and bears, and there's no medical supplies, and there's no road, and there's no electricity. But what really struck me is how contented and happy people were. You know, they weren't, no one was rushing around with the tense shoulders looking stressed. Everyone had this real sense of cheerfulness and lightheartedness and a sense of community and mutual help. I couldn't help comparing it with our Western lifestyles where we're sitting at desks and looking at computers and we're inside and we're disconnected from nature and community and our families. And it's funny because a lot of these people, the younger generation particularly, want what we've got. They're moving away. Yet we want what they've got, i.e. community and land and happiness and connection to nature. So we've all got it all upside down, inside out.
And what about the idea with Shangri-La that people stay young forever?
Do you know, I did meet a lot of people in these villages who, 60-year-olds who looked 30. I mean, there were a few 60-year-old men where, they had their tops off working in the fields, and I was like, what? 30, they looked 30 years old. It was really, it was odd. It was a very unusual place.
Yeah. And has it made you believe in this idea of Shangri-La more? Is that...
It hasn't really hard... I don't think... There is a real Shangri-La, like in kind of James Hilton's book, Lost Horizon. But it made me believe in the importance of living in communities, being connected with nature and not sitting at a computer all day. And since I've come back, I've been trying to think a lot about how to get more of that in my life and how important these things are to our life.
I mean, reading the book, this section of it, you are absolutely joyful in it. Yeah. I mean, you're pretty chipper the whole way through, particularly given the adventures that you're having. But here you really, there is that happy glow about you. And I wonder, given that, this adventure almost didn't happen, whether you looked back from there and thought, I'm really glad that it has.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about how that it almost didn't happen.
Yeah, so it took me about two and a half, three years from the moment I first had the idea to do this book to actually go on the journey. And actually, today is February the 1st. It was exactly today, 2 years ago, that I began the journey. And it was delayed by about a year and a half because the year before I was going to leave, I suddenly developed really severe panic attacks. And I spent about 6 months really unable to work, unable to do anything, really. And it was just, it was incredibly crippling. It totally transformed my life and turned it upside down. And it was the notion that I really wanted to go on this journey that really helped me get better. I kind of treated getting better as an exam I couldn't fail. But when I got on the aeroplane to fly to India, I was literally sitting on the plane reading Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, thinking, I really don't know if I'm up to this. I don't know if I'm going to have a complete wig out in week one and come home. But the journey was hugely healing. And the more I went on and the more I realized I was well again, the happier I got. So it was a really magical journey in so many ways, very healing.
And do you have advice for people who maybe don't have the full-on panic attacks but might panic at the idea of going on a journey like this? I mean, what sort of... Obviously, you're inspirational, but what sort of advice would you offer?
Well, I think you've got to remember that fears aren't real and that the fear of something is always so much worse than the actual reality of doing it. And that if we give in to our fears, we'll end up just staying at home watching EastEnders. We have to keep challenging ourselves. And the more we challenge ourselves, the more exciting our life gets. So you've just got to ride through those fears and remember, this isn't real, this isn't real, this is my mind playing tricks. I'm going to be all right.
Okay, well, let's talk about another inspirational woman, and that is Ursula.
Has anyone heard of Ursula Graham Bower? Ah, this lady. Excellent. So Ursula Graham Bower is a lady that we should all have heard of. And this is her. She... In 1937, aged 23, she set sail for India with the idea of going to Nagaland, which is the neighbouring state to Arunachal Pradesh. And she wanted to potter around with her camera and take a few photos. And a few years later, she was captaining a 150-strong Naga guerrilla unit against the advancing Japanese. And she was incredibly successful guerrilla commander, and the Naga worshipped her as a goddess. And she is was one of the very few women to fight in the Second World War and remains to this day, to my knowledge, the only female guerrilla commander in the history of the British Army. She was incredible. I mean, she was as at home with a Bacardi as she was with a Bren gun. She was just awesome.
And she writes about the Apatani tribe, doesn't she?
Yes. Yeah, so after the war, she married another guerrilla commander who was a very laid-back chap who called Tim, who'd been a tea planter. And they went to live with the Apatani tribe in Arunachal Pradesh, which is kind of the next valley along from Pemmico. And this is a picture of one of the Apatani tribe they worked with in Arunachal Pradesh. This is 1946, they were there. And she wrote this wonderful book, The Hidden Land. If anyone gets a chance to read it, The Hidden Land, it's a really great book. And this is the Apatani Valley, so different from anywhere else in Arunachal Pradesh. And so, yeah, I really wanted to go back to the Apatani Valley and see what it was like 70 years later and see how much things would have changed since Ursula's time.
And what did you find?
What I found was I was there over Easter weekend, and I have to say it was probably the oddest Easter I've ever spent, because the Apatani, like many tribes in Arunachal Pradesh, are currently being heavily Christianized by missionaries from other Indian states. And so the tribe was being kind of rent asunder from within by this division between Christians and people who are still practicing animism. So Easter Saturday, I experienced the animist side of the tribe, and this is a shaman. And you can't see it here, but he was wearing a wig to ape the old-fashioned hairstyle of a sort of top knot, and he was wearing extremely short shorts, the sort of shorts which you worry there might be an accident any moment, you don't know quite anywhere to look. But he was, you know, practicing, he was sacrificing chickens and divining omens from their livers. So that was Easter Saturday. Easter Sunday, I went to church. I went to one of the many revivalist churches in the valleys, and there was this big congregation of about 100 people, a lot of them like this old lady. And they were all standing up and sort of speaking in tongues and screaming and singing hallelujah and passing out. It was so odd. Mm. So I really wanted to understand, why are people converting? Why are people like this older lady converting to Christianity? Mm. And I met a few of these older Christians, and they basically said, well, animism is really expensive. We spent our whole lives sacrificing animals. And the shaman just ripped us off all the time. And, you know, with Christianity, there's only one God. It's much cheaper. So it was kind of spiritual bargaining, really.
But in the book, you say that they weren't actually the happiest ones, were they?
No, I felt the Apatani were the only tribe I came away from who I felt really sad, because I spoke to both sides, the old people practicing shamanism and the Christians, and I just felt like the tribe was falling apart, and there was this real hostility between both sides and conflict. I felt that they were a tribe who were in trouble, really, and perhaps in a generation the old ways will have gone entirely. Mm. And how different, because they were practicing this facial tattooing and nose plugs until the 70s.
So what's the significance of the facial tattoos and the other facial decorations?
So the tattoos were a sort of coming of age thing. Women would be forced to do it when they're about 10 years old. Painful. And the nose plugs, there used to be a lot of slave raiding in this area, and the Apatani women were allegedly very beautiful. So their elders, again, when they were in their teenage years, would do this resin nose plug thing to apparently make them less beautiful and stop them being stolen for slaves.
And does that still happen at all?
No. That finished along. But it was happening in the 1946, when Ursula was writing her book. It was very much still happening. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Constant tribal warfare and slave raiding.
So you move on from the Apatani and head up to Tawang.
Tawang, yes. So Tawang was in the very far northwestern corner. It's just sandwiched between Tibet and Bhutan. And it was the first place the Dalai Lama got to when he escaped from Tibet in 1959. He walked over the mountains, came to Tawang. But there was only one road connecting Tawang with the rest of India, and it went over this very high pass, the Selah Pass, 4,170 metres. And my little bike, I haven't talked about the bike much, my hero. It really was my hero. It was so fantastic. but it didn't really like altitude, and I had to get it over this 4,000 meter pass. So I kind of bunny hopped up to it, and then eventually had to, I won't bore you with mechanics, but I had to butcher the carburetor and take the air filter out, and I sort of crawled over the Solar Pass at 5 miles an hour and got to Tawang.
In terms of authority figures, how did they view you? I'm thinking about the story about Where's John?
Oh, yes. So, I don't think we mentioned at the beginning that this part of the world was totally closed to foreigners until the late 90s, and you still have to get all these permits to go there. And you're not supposed to travel independently. You're supposed to be in a group with a guide. So, long story, but I'd eventually got this permit with another man's name on it. It was John someone. And so every time I came to a checkpoint to get into Arunachal Pradesh, the police would look at this and they'd look at me and they'd just say, "Where's John?" And I'd be like, "He's coming," or "He's gone ahead," or something. And they'd like be sort of like looking in the bushes and like, "What have you done with John?" But they were never unfriendly. I mean, I didn't have any problems with police or authority. They were just a bit confused. And some of them would say, "We've never seen a Britisher before."
That's fantastic for you, though. That, I mean, as a travel writer and an adventurer, it doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No, I know. And I stayed, particularly with the Idu Mishmi, I stayed with people right up on the Tibeto-Indian border who had never, ever slapped eyes on a foreigner before. Yeah. And it was good fun.
And so what about the people in this area?
So in Tawang, again, very different tribe and culture. This is the Monpa tribe, again, a sort of Bhutanese, Tibetan Buddhists. And they wear these wonderful yak wool hats to sort of keep the rain off your face. So the idea is that the rain drips down the wool.
Fantastic.
And they have a very unique...
I can see those being sold at destinations, can't you? I think they look quite
They're
the
really
part.
Itchy.
Oh, were they?
Oh, really itchy. Yeah, you can wear them for a bit and then just...
Yeah.
But the Monpa are really unique in that they have this... they're one of the only people... I think the only people left in the world who practice river burial. So they chop the corpses up... Sorry, close your ears if you're squeamish. Into 108 bits, 108 being a Buddhist karmic number, and throw them into the river. And I met a guy, actually, who was his village chopper. And he told me all about it in great detail. And then at the end, I said, "You're not a vegetarian, are you?" And he went, "Yep." I mean, God, yeah, it was bad.
Yeah, yeah. But as you said, actually probably quite sensible for that environment.
Very sensible, because very difficult to dig graves because the ground's so hard. It's 3,500 metres. Don't know about the vulture population here because there's lots of sky burials in Tibet. So it's a really efficient way of getting rid of corpses.
Things won't disintegrate.
Yeah, and it's also to do with Buddhist non-attachment. Like, you died and the soul's gone. It's nothing. It is literally a piece of meat. Like, feed it to the fish. Why not? Mm. I don't think I'd like to be the chopper, though.
Mm. No. No. Don't give up the day job. Okay, so now let's... We're getting towards the end now, but this is a lovely story of you and the nuns.
Yes. I went to stay in a Monpa... Oh, the slide's gone. We've lost the slide. Oh, there. No. That's right. Anyway, I'll just carry on talking and hopefully the right slide will come back. But that photo was of me with these two nuns called Tenzin and Purpa. And I went to stay in their nunnery in Tawang. It was quite a surprising experience. Because I suppose there's certain things you expect to do in a nunnery. You expect to pray and get up early. And they got me drunk.
Again?
God, I really am not a big drinker. But anyway, don't go away with the wrong impression of me. But because it was really cold, Tawang was freezing. It was about -5, -10. And staying in this nunnery, and we had to get up at 3 a.m. for prayers, and they were worried that I was a guest and I wasn't going to be comfortable, so I had to drink this hot chang. And I was like, "Oh, I don't want it." And they were literally, they were total pushers. Mm. And I ended up being tucked up into bed by these two nuns. An 11-year-old nun tucked me into bed.
Lovely.
With me sort of like slightly like crying because I was so drunk and happy and grateful.
And so were they... It's quite young, 11. Is that's a sort of normal time to go into a nunnery in that area?
The tradition is, and it's the same with monks, that the middle child gets given to the monastery or nunnery, and the age is about 5. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, really young.
Yeah. And were they happy?
They were happy. And I asked them this, and obviously I was there for a few days and I observed them. I ended up teaching them English and teaching at their school, and I actually thought the idea of being a nun was quite appealing, because again, that thing of like, they don't have to worry about mortgages or house prices or who they're going to marry or what job they're going to do. They live in this loving, nurturing community where they, you know, they're cared for and they care for each other. I mean, I was quite tempted. I'm not sure what my boyfriend would say. but I thought, you know, the simple life.
Yeah.
I'm just not really good at getting up at 3 a.m. in the morning.
No, that would be a trial. That would be a trial. Right, let's get the microphone out. And if anybody's got a question, do stick up your hand. Anybody?
Because people just contemplate their thoughts. Mm. This is obviously, you probably get asked, how do you reacclimatise when you come home? But what's it? Have you taken any spirituality from it? Are there any things that you still hark back to from your travels that have dwelt with you?
I think about that journey a great deal, and you know, one of the things I did before and I did throughout, and a lot of people there do, is meditation. And I still do that most mornings. And I think that's really helpful. And I think that journey was there's so many odd things happened to me. It was the most bizarre, magical. It felt like something was on my side. And I can't forget that. Yeah. I'm not a religious person, but something weird was happening.
But you did also, those nuns also gave you some very special prayer beads, didn't they?
Oh,
that
yes.
You've kept.
Yes, so Purpa, the older nun, she, as I was leaving, she just very spontaneously got these prayer beads out of her pocket and she gave them to me. And she'd been given them by the Dalai Lama when he'd visited a few years before. And of course, I've always kept those prayer beads. And when I was writing my book, I'd had them beside my desk all the time. And if I was having a real problem with, you know, lack of inspiration, I'd wrap them around my head. Be like, I'm sure this is going to help.
Any other questions? Yeah.
I've got two, actually. First of all, how long did the trip take?
Sorry.
How long did the trip actually take? And were you taken ill at all while you were away?
How long did the trip take and were you taken ill?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the trip took 2.5 months. And I wasn't ill at all. I am really lucky in that I've got a really, really strong stomach. I mean, I was eating the most extraordinary things and, you know, watching people prepare food with just muddy hands, and I didn't get ill once. I brought up in a sort of farm in Norfolk with sort of my mother's pug sitting on the kitchen table and the gerbil living in the kitchen and the pigs walking into the kitchen. So I think that's helped my strong stomach.
Question over here.
Hi, were there any tourists from other parts of India visiting that area?
So the eastern part, the Mishmi Hills, there are just no tourists. No one goes there. The only place I did meet a few people was in Tawang, and I actually met a few Indians who were riding up there on their Enfields, because it's an amazing biking road. But just the eastern part of the state, because it's much further away, much more inaccessible, and there's nothing to see in terms of famous temples, those sort of, you know, landmarks. There's just no one there.
Any more for any more? Yeah?
Yes. Could you give us the name of the book you mentioned? So
the book was Ursula Graham Bauer. And it's called The Hidden Land. But she has also written another book called Naga Path, which is about her time with the Naga. And she's an amazing writer. I don't know why she's not really famous.
And she's an anthropologist, wasn't she?
She wasn't officially an anthropologist, but she was sort of self-taught. Mm, yeah.
Okay. And you met her daughter, didn't you?
I didn't meet her daughter, but her daughter is still alive and lives in Delhi, and she helped me a lot and put me in contact with people, and she fact-checked all my chapters about her to make sure I hadn't done any howlers.
Right.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So I hope to meet her daughter.
Yeah, one day. I have one final question. The teddy bear, does that go everywhere with you?
I'm quite a superstitious traveller, so I take, like, I've got a little Buddha that goes in my pocket, and like lucky stone and lucky pants, and yeah, and I have a teddy bear. Yes.
There's nothing to be ashamed of, I think. How big is this bear?
It's about that big.
Okay.
And I actually lost it. I was in India earlier, 2017, filming, and I lost it. And I made the producer we were working with take me back to this hotel and ask them for the teddy bear, and they couldn't find it. I felt like a bit of a child.
To get a new teddy bear.
Yeah, new teddy bear.
Okay.
So thank you so much. Antonia is going to be over at the Stamford's travel stand. It's a lovely book. It's beautifully lyrically written, as well as packed full of lots of information, historical, geographical, right up to the minute stuff. So do carry on the conversation over there and go and meet Antonia. Thank you very much to you for coming. And thank you, Antonia Bolingbroke-Kent.
Thanks, Julia. Thanks for coming. I hope you could hear me.